Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Markets flashing, green rally signals. Radiation in Japan is continuing to pour into the Pacific. Government money is clearly being pushed into the markets. And Tom McClellan will be our guest today. All this and more on episode 206 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Thanks for joining me. As always, this is Andrew Horowitz. And we have lots to talk about today, and we're going to get into some of the internals of the market with Tom McClellan. He's the best when it comes to this because he really looks at the inner details, the guts, if you will, of the markets, and looking at the oscillator that he has his name for and all the different components that go into what makes a rising and a falling market, a solid underpinning for markets, and maybe even a trapdoor in some circumstances. So before we get into that, I want to just a couple of housekeeping points and answer a couple of listener questions. By the way, you can always ask me anything you'd like. I'll do my best to answer it on the air. It's askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Also, I'll mention that the Jason Taylor charity that we've been working so hard at, this is going to be the last call for anybody that wants to donate. And for those of you who have, which is a lot of you, I really appreciate all that you've done. If you donate $25 or $50, that would be great. There's a link right on the page at thedisciplinedinvestor.com on the right-hand side as well as in the show notes. And if you want, if you give $100, what we will do is we will actually send you a book signed, and you have your own copy of the Disciplined Investor or the Winning Investor. And I really appreciate that. If you could do that, that would be just terrific. It's a great cause. It gets the kids off the streets. It brings them into a great and safe atmosphere. Teach them some reading skills they really need down in some under covered areas in South Florida, et cetera, as well as the fact that it has some great programs for not only sports, but you know, just all sorts of cultural achievement and just broadening their world experience. The other thing I'll mention to you is that I do get emails, and I don't always mention this. I do sometimes. But if you do have the desire to follow along what we've talked about and you like some of the things that we've said here and on DH Unplugged, et cetera, we do manage money for clients. It's a $50,000 minimum for the TDI Managed Growth Strategy, where we have an actively traded and an aggressive strategy, both long and short, utilizing options and stocks and ETFs. All you have to do is go over to the Disciplined Investor again, click on the little blue box there, and it says just check out the virtual tour. You can take a virtual tour, see what it's all about. If you've kind of been wondering, oh, I want to be in this market or I want to be out of this market, I don't know what to do, well, that's where we come in and we try to do our best to bring the opportunities to the portfolio the best we can. So if you want to do that. All right, so we covered that. Let's cover a couple of quick listener emails that I have here. Let me just rustle them up here. A couple of things that hit that I wanted to discuss. And the first one's a quickie, and this is from John, and he talked about episode number 201 when we talked about commodity futures and how they tie into the bigger picture of the markets. And I talked about how there were some rules about, or maybe lack of rules that were out there about talking about stocks and the disclaimers that go along with it. And he says, when does something cross the line between an education, a demonstration, and advice? He says he works for a firm that they always make a really big deal about advice versus some other kind of opinion, and they give a list of words that you shouldn't use. Is there something like that in the investing world too? That's a great question, because so many times you will look at a blog post or maybe even a news publication, you'll listen to a podcast, you'll see something on TV, and you could swear that they're just, you know, hopefully just giving you unbiased, quote unquote, unbiased advice that is something that you could use. But how do you know? How do you know if maybe they hold a big piece of it? You know, look what happened last week. This is a great example right now, because look what happened last week with Sokol over at Berkshire Hathaway, where he bought, I think it was 90,000 shares of Lubrizol, made a call to the company to talk to the management. The management over at Lubrizol thought that they were talking with one of the higher-ups over at Berkshire Hathaway. And in fact, he was going there for a personal discussion, it seems, from the information we've gathered. And he got in to talk to management about his about the company. Now, a few months later, he then recommended that Warren Buffett take a look at this company. Now, was it disclosed? Wasn't it disclosed? I don't know. I'm not going to doubt that. I'm sure it was disclosed that he had some shares there. But there was a conflict of interest, it seems, from the outside. So putting that aside, though, that's the fine line, right? Is there a conflict of interest? Is there a conflict of interest with regards to the recommendation? And if there is, that should be disclosed. You should be able to find out whether there is a long, or potentially at least, a long or a short position, so you understand what is the frame of mind of the writer. Does the writer have the, are they actually, looking at the stock or the sector or the situation from a point of view that is, clean, clear, and unbiased or not? I think that's a big issue. So I think that when we, especially on this show, when we talk about some things, realize that we may own some of those securities, we may not. When you listen to some people on the television, realize when they say the same names over and over, like a J.P. Morgan, when they talk about on Fast Money all the time, it used to be Goldman. When they talk about Caterpillar with Cramer, or Lululemon, not that they're not bad stocks, but realize that there needs to be a disclosure along with that. And they're not, I would say they're in violation of what the SEC or the state authorities recommend. So keep that in mind. Second quick question. Jason sends in, he says, recently my little brother opened an investment account and bought SLV, the silver ETF. So I looked into silver last weekend and it seems a horrible time to buy silver. I did something and I did some more digging and my first analysis, well, he gave me this whole long analysis. And he thought he'd find it interesting and I was wondering if I could cover the sector in my next podcast. Jason, silver is being run by a few different undercurrents right now, we'll call it. There's been a real demand for alternative currencies right now, right? We've seen that. We've seen that gold has been moving up and a variety of the other precious metals. And silver is kind of a hybrid. It's in the precious metals, but it's also in the industrial metals group, which makes it kind of a cool play. And what's happening now is that a lot of countries are starting to talk again very recently about alternatives to the U.S. dollar, as we see the U.S. dollar just getting plummeted and bludgeoned almost on a daily basis, no matter what the news is. And silver, while it may not be the best investment right now, it is a go-to and it is a momentum play for those that are looking for alternatives to currency and for gold, for that matter. Now, the other thing to mention about silver is, these ETFs that have been created over the last several years have allowed people to buy commodities in vast amounts with a small amount of money. Now, that may seem contradictory, but let me tell you what I mean. So in the quote-unquote old days, when you bought silver and you had to buy the commodity or the future on that commodity, you would have to pony up some sizable amounts of money. Not a lot of people understood how the futures market worked. Nobody really wanted to take the risk of having physical delivery. Well, here's the difference. The difference is you can go out with $50, $100, $500, $5,000 very easily and buy SLV. Or you may be buying a mutual fund that's a commodity-based mutual fund that has silver in it. Or you may be buying some other type of ETN or ETF that is a basket of metals, and you're going to have the opportunity to buy silver in there. And what that does is it artificially creates a market for silver. Why do you think that Alcoa is so excited about the idea of having an aluminum ETF? Think about that. If the ETF requires to have a backup of the actual commodity, think about all the production that could be for the aluminum companies. Think about all the production this creates for the silver companies with the silver ETF. Now, obviously, one day, in theory, this could really backfire pretty badly, right? These ETFs that have all these commodities all of a sudden aren't being bought. There's a glut of the commodity on the market. It's being sold. And then what? Now you got the companies who are producing this really saying, we don't have any more production demands. We're seeing the price plummet on this, and therefore we're less profitable. And where's the next opportunity going to come from? Because now there's a glut of this commodity on the market. Again, potential situation in the future. That's what happened during 2008, right? That's what, really, if you think about what happened, was there so much less demand for oil that dropped it down to the 30s? Or was it that there was such a glut of oil to begin with and the buying that didn't continue in the area of the commodities and the dumping that went on created just a massive amount of a discrepancy in the supply-demand chain? So silver may not be the best investment long-term, but right now it's clearly a favorite of those that are looking for alternatives and for sovereign government wealth funds and for governments that are looking to have a backup of a currency. So there you go. So let's get some of the topics before we get to Tom McClellan. The markets clearly have reversed again off of the 200-day moving average for most of them. The S&P 500, the Russell 2000, the NASDAQ, these have had a big reversal, which once again shows institutional support, right? When you see the 50-day line being touched, or maybe even the 200-day moving average touched, 10-week, 40-week, and bounced off pretty successfully, well, you'd say that there clearly has to be some institutional support. There's their buying mechanism. They like to wait for that pullback and then buy. At the same time, what you want to see, which we haven't really seen, though, is an increase in volume on individual stocks or on the markets. Now, this is one of those things that's really had a lot of controversy and a lot of strange signals over the last number of months, because we've seen a lot of breakdowns on very big volume and then the move back up on just kind of moving and drudging higher on very low volume. As a matter of fact, last week was some of the lowest volume in 2011, back to, I think, in probably November of 2010. What does that mean? Well, it means that there's just not a lot of broad participation. And do you blame anybody? I mean, you have the nuclear and plutonium and radiation situation in Japan. You have the continuing uprisings now in Syria, Yemen, Libya, still in Egypt. There's a lot going on. Saudi Arabia calmed their situation by doling out, I don't know, $75 or $80 billion. And the continuation of what's going on with the downgrades of Portugal and the various European countries, the bailout of the banks of Ireland, and so on and so on. The increase in inflation in the U.S. and the question about quantitative easing and the end. And a lot of differential Fed talk and Fed speak over the last few weeks. We've heard some that says, hey, end it early, and some says, hey, we're going to continue it on. So who knows what they're talking about. Just take it as noise right now, because until we hear the big boys talking, the Bernanke's, Yellen's, et cetera, I mean, they want to spend this money. They have it. They feel that they've have the right to do it, and they want to do everything they can to make sure that we have basically destroyed the dollar and created an inflationary environment so that we would have people rush in to buy homes and to do the things that they do in an expansionary economic time. So while the markets are flashing green, which is great, you know, it's a good time to consider, okay, you know, clearly there's support of these markets, and it looks like that earnings around the world has, you know, the opportunity to improve, et cetera. But, you know, put in there that you do have these crazy situations going on, not to mention $108 crude oil, $118 on Brent. So there's a little bit of cautionary optimism going on right now. We think that right now you follow the trend, and that's all there is to it. Put a little bit of a hedge in your portfolio so that if things do fall, like a VIX hedge, hey, that would work out well. And at least stop you from getting crushed if things do move down, and buy the best stocks you can, the ones with the greatest fundamentals and underlying solid nature, those that are breaking out, you know, companies that have maybe in the healthcare area, you know, for example, Alexion Pharmaceuticals, a Perrigo, which we own, recently saw some breakouts. And, you know, you look to both the companies that are the go-to companies with the fine balance sheets on a global basis, and those that are showing some real support, both in the ups and down market conditions that we've recently seen. But rest assured that we'll see this bounciness for some time until a lot of this uncertainty passes. Now, one of the things that we did talk about, and there hasn't been a lot of, I don't know, it doesn't seem like there's a lot of concern about the radioactive runoff, the highly toxic runoff that we've been experiencing in Japan. You know, we've seen that the reactor 2 has been spilling a lot of radiation that is both the one that will decay in 8 days and the one that has, like, a longer three-year half-life, et cetera. Without all that technical gobbledygook, the bottom line is that we are seeing a continuation of the radiation situation get worse and worse in Japan. It's not getting better. It's clearly not getting better. Now, realize something, that we're getting mixed messages from TEPCO. They say, hey, you know what? There's a million times the average. And they come back and say, no, there's not. We get our Department of Energy saying, hey, there's a big problem over there. And, you know, it looks like there's a breach in the core and a meltdown. And then the Japan ministry says, oh, no, it's not really that bad. And then they come out 2 days later and say, yes, it's bad. And, you know, people aren't going to be able to go back there for some time. We're going to bail out TEPCO. We're not going to bail out TEPCO. And, you know, you can go on and on with this comedy, because that's all it is. It's testing the water, so to speak, of the markets, because everybody's so afraid of busting these markets. There's this fear by governments that we can go down that rabbit hole once again, where the continual selling just moves in. And that's why there's so many underpinnings of the ability for these governments to buy directly into their stock markets. Don't think that's not happening. We know that because it's been told to us by those governments. Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia's government bought in billions of dollars to stabilize their markets after there was all the decay after the eruptions in the Middle East. They said they're going in and buying the companies. Italy is now creating a sovereign wealth fund, and they're going to buy the companies of Italy to prop up those stocks. We saw the same thing, and we know for a fact that Japan has on order the ability to purchase Japanese stocks in the open markets, thereby holding it up. And you say, well, Andrew, if that's the case, why not invest? I'm not saying don't. But there has to be a normalized end to some of this, because this is not the way that stock markets work. You can't have the government just buying all of this, because it just won't work that way. And I'm not suggesting they're the only ones buying, clearly. But, you know, there is a point that are these markets socialized? No. This is supposed to be capitalism. I don't care if you're in a communist country or if you're in a purely capitalistic society. This is not supposed to be a socialized market, which it's become. I don't know, you know, as an investor, if you're long, you want it to be that, oh, that's great, jolly-o, let's just invest and have the government support it. Happy days. Woohoo! Right? I mean, you know, on the other hand, when you start to see, you know, some of these, you know, bearish commentaries, you know, they're just pissed off about it. And if you want to stay right in the middle, you would want this to be a purely capitalistic, market-based system that operates on the merit of earnings and potential long-term growth trends. So we're seeing this around the world, and it's a kind of an interesting phenomena. But at the same time, you have to realize that, you know, you can't fight it. Governments are just too big. At least they are right now. Yes, they're shrinking by the size of their debt. And, you know, we're seeing the continuation of the bailouts in Ireland. The Irish banks are basically getting a bailout right now. Portugal's on the brink. By next week or the week after, I would venture to say that they're going to get a bailout, because they've already tried to float some debt last week, and they did it above market, the highest rate they've done in years. And that's just not going to work. It's just not going to work. Already we saw that Ireland. Let me think about that for a second. I think it was Ireland last week that they said that don't worry about the ratings. They're going to give them a buy. Basically that they no longer meet the criteria of the rating that is required to be in the EU. So what did the EU do? Well, they did the smart thing. They said, those ratings don't matter anymore. They said, you know what? We're making an exception. And they even hinted that they're no longer going to allow and recognize the U.S. rating firms from providing the rating. Oh, wait a minute. If you have on the books, you really got to think about this for a second. If you have on the books that this is a requirement in order to be in the EU, and you want to maintain the sanctity of the euro and the confidence of the investor, and then you just basically take your rules and throw them out, like they did, by the way, when they recently bought the bonds of remember they said they weren't going to buy directly the bonds in the open market of other countries, right? They weren't going to, but they did it anyway. They waived the rule. They had to. At least they said they had to. And then they again threw the rule book out when they said they're going to not allow or not, they're not going to recognize or not look at the rating, give them a waiver. What's the point of the rule book if all they can do is change the rules? It's like the stress test. Listen, the stress tests were the same situation. You know, if they didn't meet the stress tests, we know they were going to change the stress test requirements. That's what they do. That's what this market is all about. It's a confidence game at the highest levels. And that's fine. That's okay. As long as the governments are behind it and they don't screw it up royally, it's fine. When it changes, it changes. But realize that that's what's going on. I guess that's the most important part of this, right? You can have some confidence in the companies that do well, clearly, individual situations and all that. You know, I don't know how you have much confidence in some of the banks out there. It's very difficult to understand their balance sheets. It's very difficult to understand what's going on. And then, you know, you get the government saying, okay, now you can pay a dividend. And you know, they come out with gigantic dividends, and then they have to be backed off. Some banks are not allowed to. I mean, you can go on and on and on in this whole situation and realize that, you know, maybe it's a farce, maybe it's not. Maybe it's real, maybe it's not. Maybe it's something you want to invest in, maybe it's not. The banks, we can't find reason to invest in. I can't find anything in the majors, you know, put a few aside, but that you really feel comfortable with. Why would you invest in Citi? Why would you invest in a Bank of America? I mean, you got to scratch your head about those. They could come back, they're low price, blah, blah, blah. But you know what? If you want to do any analysis, it's almost impossible. It's almost impossible. Anyway, so the other thing I want to talk about, there's a couple of things coming up next week that we need to really pay attention to. Now, did you notice that last week we had some, I would say mixed economic numbers, leaning towards obviously the positive because we want to see the positive in things right now. It's kind of the way the markets are going. But we saw the jobs number come out on Friday that we saw at 8.8%, surprised everybody, 8.8% unemployment rate, clearly still kind of running with that whole structural imbalance with the labor force participation rate that we know about. Less people working, it kind of skews the numbers a bit. But we saw about a 216,000 survey come out, which was better, and there was definitely less government jobs. So the private employment was actually better. That's good. The average hourly earnings on a month-over-month basis was a little bit less. The survey called for about up 0.2% on a month-over-month. It came in at zero. So people are making less money and working harder. Okay. Average hourly workings on a year-over-year was down also. The average hourly work week was right where it was expected to be. But we saw construction spending kind of not in great shape at all. The ISM manufacturing came in okay, but it was definitely down from where it was. I will tell you which was one of the most concerning numbers that came out last week, and that was the prices paid number component of the ISM survey. In other words, the manufacturing survey. Why was it was concerning? Because it was probably the highest we've seen in some time. We'll cut to the chase and call that inflationary. Meaning the input prices, which we've been talking about for several months, are going to increase regardless of what Ben Bernanke says and what he is willing and what he's hoping for. The more he pushes on the QE2 and the more they push on, you know, killing the dollar, the more you're going to see commodity prices rising as they have. That is creating input pressure and creating a rise in the prices paid index. Now, obviously, we talked about this ad nauseum, so we're not going to kind of really hit on this too hard, but there is inflation going on around the world. It's just not the way we want to see it. Not the way the core inflation, which is less volatile. But the core inflation does not put into consideration many of the things that you and I pay. The gas prices, food prices, etc. You know, and what we're going to have to see is next week on Monday, we're going to see the ISM non-manufacturing or the service index come out. Expectations are for that to be about 60. And that's one that could be hit a little bit harder and faster because the service business, you know, you have to look at consumer confidence a little bit more closely when it comes to the service index. Because, you know, that's what people directly deal with kind of right out of the box, right? So the manufacturing may continue and it may see inventories increase until stores can actually get a handle on where the buying is. A little bit more of a slower process. But services, more of a direct-to-consumer, I would say. So we're going to see what that comes out. Expectations are somewhere about 59.9, we'll call it 60. But also we're going to see the prices paid or some of the components in there, and we're going to have to see what that comes out to be. Then we have, of course, the new mortgage applications. We have the minutes of the Federal Open Market Committee that is going to come out, and they'll give us a little bit more of a hint and see a little bit more of dissension when it comes to some of the players inside. And the rest of things we'll see during the week. I think probably the most important thing we'll see is the thing that we're going to see on the 5th which is the ISM non-manufacturing composite. But also, I think what will be really key is going to be the continuing claims and the initial claims on Thursday, because that's going to show us if any of the Japanese situation and any of the concerns that we've seen recently are starting to show up. We'll see if that kind of pops above or near the 400,000 mark, if it starts turning around a little bit. And the other thing is, we're going to see the inventory number that comes out at the end of the week, and it'll be really important to see if the inventories are starting to spike up when it comes to the relationship of inventory to sales. We want to see that sales are basically continuing to keep up or keep pace with the inventory expansion, right? And if you see an inventory to sales ratio that starts creeping up the wrong way, that means inventories are rising faster than sales are happening. So we're going to see some of that next week, and I think that's going to be a really good indication of the effect of some of the things we've seen in the first part of this year. And we can make kind of a final, not a final, but we can make a more, I think, educated decision about directional matters when it comes to many of the events that have happened over the last several weeks, several months, and what the impact of the higher price of commodities and especially oil are going to have on the markets. The last thing I'll mention to you is this, that I think it was last week President Obama gave a speech, and he talked about how, you know, this whole energy plan that we have to have here and the whole requirement to have a better energy policy. There's no question about that. But when he started talking about how we were going to basically run out of oil and there's going to be the continual expansion for the need and consumption of oil from countries like China, Asia, India, that I think was a really bad move. Because I think that really solidified the bullish traders and the speculators in oil, and it created their optimism and bullish tendencies and then ramped up oil right after that. Because, you know, where's the timing on that? We have this whole situation going on with in the Middle East. We have the dollar sinking, which pushes up oil. And then we have President Obama saying we are going to run out of oil, essentially. That's kind of a timing I don't think was the best for that. I think he could have been a little bit more, well, we'll say diplomatic, political, or softer, gentler when it came to that conversation. Because I don't think that did anything to help oil prices stabilize. Even Saudi Arabia this weekend said that they are looking for alternatives because their consumption requirements in their country are just spiking. They're looking at putting in $100 billion. I think it was $100 billion. $100 billion over the next 10 years into solar and other renewable energy sources. Interesting. Saudi Arabia. This is good for potentially the continuation of the trend that we've recently seen in solar. You know, you got companies like Ajinko Solar, we own Trina Solar, TSL, great balance sheet, great fundamentals. Very sloppy trading, I'll tell you that right now, because, you know, the solar is still an unloved situation and get a lot of question about where the next opportunity is going to come from and what government's going to stop or increase their spending or, give some benefits to the solar industry. First Solar, which everybody loves to hate, especially Barron's just loves to hate that stock. And, a few other names, GT Solar, some of the smaller players out there, and some of the suppliers of the PPO and some of the other ones that supply the industry. So there's really good opportunity out there if there really is going to be an alternative energy push. A lot of people right now are still betting on the whole natural gas situation. You know, look at Gulf Energy, for example, something we own, GPOR, or look at, BEXP or BTU. I mean, these are a combination of shale plays, Balkan plays, oil and natural gas, and it's kind of interesting how well they're doing of late, especially with the consideration that they've kind of not had any real benefit from the natural gas pricing and the consumption pricing. Just look what happened to inventories last week. You know, natural gas was moving up nicely over the last couple of weeks, and then inventories came out. And it's like, oh man, there is still so much natural gas out there that look at that, inventories are out of control. They just keep growing and growing. So anyway, we'll end with that point right there and kind of continue up with the next part of this, which is what I promised you, our guest, Tom McClellan. One of my favorite guys to bring on to talk about some of the good internals about the market, because this is one of the areas that he really studies is Tom McClellan. And he writes not only the McClellan Report, and he's named after the McClellan Oscillator, right, Tom?
The McClellan Oscillator was created by my parents I had no hand in that because they did it when I was about 9 years old, so I wasn't much help in calculating exponential moving averages at that time. I've gotten better since age 9, though.
Well, that's good. But, I mean, there's a lot that goes into that, and one of the main, I guess the way that you look at this whole thing is that when you look at the McClellan oscillator, we've talked about this before, it really just gives you a kind of a sense of what's going up and what's going down in what, in other words, if just everything is going up or down at one time, it would show you a very steep incline or decline or bouncing off the bottom or top. But if everything's kind of just hanging out there, you can see it right in the kind of in that fatty middle part, right?
Well, the McClellan oscillator measures the acceleration upward or downward, the acceleration taking place in the advanced decline statistics. And so if you have a condition like we're seeing in the last 10 days where you have a hugely strong plurality of stocks going up every day versus going down, then the advanced decline line will be accelerating upward at a rapid pace. And so that's what the McClellan oscillator is able to detect and to convey mathematically.
You know, one of the things that I've always said is that this is very simplistic, and then I want to get into a different topic. But if you ever see the McClellan oscillator get really oversold, down to I look at about the 250, 260 line on the daily oscillator. I have kind of a couple of lines drawn across. And if you ever see it kind of get to that level, it is rather interesting how very soon after that, on many occasions, you see either a bounce or a change of direction to a rally and vice versa. That's something you notice too, obviously, right?
And you don't see those very often. So
right.
when somebody gives you a hanging curveball like that, it's nice to say, I know what to do with this. Conversely, though, when you see the oscillator get up to a very high positive reading, it's not the same meaning. A very deeply negative oscillator reading shows conclusion of the selling acceleration, whereas a very high reading above zero shows initiation. You're just getting started.
Right.
So up and down are not the same thing in interpreting the McClellan oscillator.
But what's really interesting about this, I think, is that not only I'll say this of you, but I'll say this of a few other people who have been very good at generally calling trends, not to the day. This is the last month, maybe a little bit longer, but about the last month has been a little bit confusing, right?
Well, you know, you throw an 8.9 earthquake and a tsunami at a nuclear plant, things get a little confusing and people get a little bit touchy, no matter what the trend or the liquidity situation is, that those kinds of events affect people's emotions.
So what does it mean that it took a total of, I'm going to be kind here, a week and a half for all that to be forgotten?
Well, when you have the Fed buying $6 billion worth of treasury bonds every day, all that extra liquidity tends to smooth out any of the ripples in the liquidity stream and make a much better situation. And the money starts burning holes in the bankers' pockets, and they want to do something with it. Generally, the way that the money gets out of the banks and into the economy is through the stock market.
So what you're saying, let me rephrase this, that you know, where they say that money can't buy happiness, but it sure can buy returns in the stock market. Right?
For a short amount of time, that's true.
Right.
Now, when the Fed decides to end this program of printing money and buying treasury bonds in June, simultaneously with that June end of the QE2, we're going to have the end of the favorable seasonal period of the year, which runs from about November through the end of May, early June. So you've got two bullish factors going on right now in April that are going to both come to an end in June. And the last time the Fed stopped qualitative easing and bond purchases was in April of 2010, and a month later we had a flash crash. So you can just imagine what's going to happen when they try to stop it and wean the junkie off the heroin this time.
That's exactly what it was. I mean, the flash crash was essentially a heroin junkie's withdrawal.
Yeah, it was a withdrawal a symptom, and it was an illiquidity event, very short term. There just wasn't money available to do things in the way that had been done the month before, and people weren't ready for the shift.
So
eventually, we're going to have to wean the market off of all this excess liquidity, and it's going to be hard. But that's not what's happening this month. That's not the problem we need to worry about today. That's the problem we need to put on our calendars to worry about in June when the Fed turns off the spigot.
Well, now that we know about that, though, it's not going to happen, right? I mean, now that everybody knows that this could happen, something else is going to have to come out of this. In other words, it may be earlier, later, not at all, in a different gyration. It may be something weird about bonds. Who knows? I'm just saying that, you know, once it's known that these kind of things can happen, the opportunity to make money from them is very difficult.
I understand what you're saying, that if everybody believes a certain thing, that it won't come true. I'm still of the belief that the real factors matter, and that by the time June rolls around, there will be enough complacency that people will have switched to thinking that it doesn't matter and it is going to be different this time.
So you're saying that that the information matters, which basically is going against the grain right now.
Well, the information matters, but the money matters. And for the moment, we don't need to worry about what's going to happen in August.
Yeah.
For the moment, it's April. It's the bullish period of the year. There's QE2 going on, and we're making new highs in the advanced decline line, new highs in the industrials and the transports. Small caps are leading. You've got every possible bullish factor you can think of going in your favor. It's time to ride the trend.
Yeah,
we can worry about the ending of the trend in a couple of months, but right now,
right.
We don't want to let the worries about a few months from now stop us from catching what's happening right now.
Yeah, and add to that, one of the things that I know you are have been talking about is the presidential cycle, the third year of a president's, especially first president's term, right?
Yes, exactly so. The third year is nearly always an up year. A couple of notable exceptions were 1939 when Hitler was marching through Poland, and 1931 when Oklahoma was being picked up by the winds and being deposited on the East Coast,
mm-hmm.
when we had a Dust Bowl.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't have conditions like that, then the third year is an up year. And it's been up year so far, but there's some granularity to that. The autumn of a third year can quite often have some excitement. 1987 was a good example of what can happen in the autumn of a third year.
Yeah, that was excitement.
Yeah. And it was still an up year for the overall year, but there was
a rough day.
A pothole in the way.
I remember that day. That day was, you know, it was the same thing that happened during the flash crash. You know, in the flash crash, I heard somebody saying, "Hey, the market's down 5%." That was, you know, right after I was just looking at it, and I was just doing something else for a minute. And then, oh, 6, 7. I was like, "Come on, you're kidding me!" And then, of course, it was true, and you didn't even know what to do at that point. You're like, you know, trying to find out what the reasons are, you know. And same thing in 87, which was much worse, of course, because it was just so much deeper and so much more destructive in that period. And just really, that was just all hell broke loose back then. But anyway,
And during the flash crash, nobody could believe the tape because it was ridiculous numbers.
Right.
Even though they were arguably true. In 1987, there wasn't a tape because it was running 2 hours late. So nobody knew at all what was happening.
Yeah, there was also the inability to actually do anything constructive or destructive because the machines took over and the whole systems, all the systems were just wacko in the flash crash. But it would have been nice to pick up some of those things or whatever, but they would have been busted anyway. Let's talk about the couple of things that you've talked about recently that I've read. I mean, I know that you've kind of gone back and forth, but it seems like generally speaking, you are somewhat bearish as a overall sentiment on gold. Does that sum up that point? Is that correct?
Yes and no. I see trouble in the chart, the daily chart, and when it comes to the one fundamental factor that matters for gold more than anything, we still have negative real interest rates. And when you do that, it tends to be enormously stimulative to gold. The trouble that I have, though, is that we just on March 31st made a marginal new closing high on the dollar price of gold. However, the euro price of gold has been in a downtrend for a couple months. It's already topped out and going down, and arguably what happens to the euro these days is more important to the gold market than what happens to the dollar. So that's the troubling spot that I see. That's a condition which can remedy itself at any time, but that's the reason for worry that I have right now.
One of the interesting correlations that I have recently been looking at, and I looked at a big matrix of correlations between currencies and asset classes, and then on top of that to equity markets, the euro has been an incredibly, I think, a 0.72 correlation to the S&P 500. Have you seen this?
Yeah.
That is unbelievable.
And in fact, if you look at the euro-yen cross rate as its own discrete item to look at, there's a very good correlation to what the stock market is doing. And if you, for the people who really want to get into that, if you see the S&P 500 make a higher high, but the euro-yen cross rate makes a lower high, then it's time to worry. That's not what we've been seeing lately. The euro-yen cross rate has been zooming higher, and it's been a bullish factor for the stock market.
Yeah, well, because, you know, just to kind of discuss that, the two different combinations, one of them we're talking about When the dollar yen, for example, moves higher, well, that's obviously that the dollar is gaining on the yen, and the yen is moving down in value. But when talking about the euro, the dollar is being moves down, and is then obviously the cross is beneficial to the euro. Now, one of the things that has been discussed is this kind of gigantic carry trade unwind on a couple different scenarios. The bullish factor on the euro is due to the fact that the euro region has been continually calling for, or at least have, Trichet has been saying, hey, you know, we have higher interest rates coming, potentially we have inflation, et cetera. Here in the United States, we're like, we don't see any inflation at all, you know, and we keep on pounding the table that we're not ending the QE2. There, they're on austerity. And Japan just got this gigantic amount of backstop from the G7, which looks like that the yen would have a very difficult time going below, in other words, strengthening to below 80 to the dollar. At all again. So now you have this setup, right, Tom, that basically says kill the dollar as best as possible against the euro and do what you can to kill the yen as well against all other currencies.
And you have a U.S. Congress that can't even pass a budget, and we're currently in deficit to the degree of hundreds of billion dollars, and they can't even agree about the argument over cutting $30 or $40 billion out of hundreds of billions. It's a pretty disgusting display going on.
Yeah, they could.
So yeah, there's lots of reasons that, like that you said, to think that the dollar is not such a great thing. The one argument against that, though, is that when we look at the commitment of traders data, which will be coming out on Friday of this week, and we'll get a new week's worth of data about that, the commercial traders of currency futures are net long the dollar to a huge degree. So they're betting that the dollar is going to go up. They are usually early when they make that big bet, mm-hmm. but they're usually right.
Right, and that commitment of traders.
That's the one opposite side of that argument.
Yeah, the commitment of traders report is actually generated on Friday afternoon, I think after the close of markets, but it is from the previous Tuesday, right?
It reflects positions that traders hold as of the previous Tuesday. Why it takes the CFTC 3 days to compile the statistics, I don't know. They should be able to do it with one button on a computer and boom, it's done. But that's the way it's always been done, so that's the way they continue to do it.
Well, I mean, they got to trade off of the information before they pass it on to us, right?
I didn't say that.
Anyway, so, you know, on top of this, the other thing that I find interesting is when you look at the chart, because I know you do a variety, not only the S&P 500 and not just T-bills and bonds and not just gold. What's going on with oil? Now, you wrote a great piece that I actually put up as a guest piece, guest post, if you will, last week sometime about the oil charts and the oil charts. You do these kind of a lot of these, okay, look at this pattern. It matches this pattern. So that's kind of an interesting thing that may occur. You always say it may not also, but it's just an interesting thing to look at, right?
I always want to get the answers ahead of time, whatever way I can do it.
Well, go work for the CFTC then.
The commitment of traders data on oil a couple decades ago was a great contrary indicator. When you see the commercials get up to a big net short position in oil like they have right now, that was a reliable sign of a top. It hasn't worked that way lately, and in fact, the final price highs for oil come as the commercials have unwound their big net short and they're passing right through neutral. So it's the big net short position that the commercial oil traders are showing right now is an early warning that a top in crude oil prices is coming, but it's not here yet. More important than the commercials or the speculators' position is if you look at the overall total open interest in oil futures. And just look at that on a shifted forward basis, it'll give you a leading indication of what oil prices are going to do about 9 weeks later. Mm-hmm. So we've just seen a peak a couple weeks ago in the open interest that says, and it turned down for 1 week after that. We have to wait to see until we get more data, but we could have a sign that oil is finally going to top about 6 or 7 weeks from now. But it's not done yet.
And where's the projection take you to?
I tend to worry more about the direction as opposed to the destination.
Right,
I just
want
to get the direction right, and how far it goes in that direction I care less about.
And then when it comes to the commitment of traders report, because this is something that I've kind of also had some difficulty with, because you could look at it's broken down in many different components, right? So you have the commercial traders, you have what's called the retail, and then you have the speculative.
Well, you have the commercials, the non-commercials, and the what they call the non-reportables, whose positions are too small, they're not even worth bothering with.
Right.
A non-reportable trader would be, you know, if I go down to my local CTA and I have two contracts of something, that's not even worth bothering with. And so they just set those aside. But they're the small money guys, and sometimes their opinion can be worth trading on. The large the big cap traders, the Goldman Sachs of the world, owning huge positions. They are the commercial traders, and they're presumably the smart money who knows what's going to happen.
I thought the commercial traders were just the ones that were the hedgers, and then the speculators were the Goldmans.
But it depends on the position size. So you've got three different categories of position size, and that's the only distinction they make between commercials, non-commercials, and non-reportables.
Right.
And the amount of positions in each different type of contract for oil or gas or lumber or S&P, it depends on the settings that the CFTC decides upon. So you could have one hedge fund that has a big enough position to be considered a commercial trader in one contract, but it has a smaller position and therefore is a non-commercial in another contract. So it's not as pure of a distinction as you might think it should be.
Right.
And that tends to muddle the data a little bit.
So when you look at the, I know that when people, again, we call it the COT, COT, the commitment of traders, you could take a look at this in a lot of different places, gang, just look it up. One of the things that you look at is that a lot of times the non-reportables or the retail is on the opposite side, because you only could have a one and a negative one in total on this, right? So
that's right.
When you look at this, somebody's got to take the long position, somebody's got to take the short position, and oftentimes it's not just, you would think, just down the middle, everybody's not knowing where to go. The retail is at the opposite extreme of the commercial.
Yep.
And what does that mean? I want you to say it, not me.
It's a smart money, dumb money thing.
Yeah, okay, there you go.
The little guy is not usually the smart money. The big guy who got to be the big guy because he is the smart money and he knows what's going on. That's the presumption. That's the hypothesis you operate under. That's not true across the board, of course, because some little guys are making and winning trades. But that's the operating presumption. One thing I would add, since we're talking about commitment of traders data, I used to use the S&P 500 futures data out of the commitment of traders report, and it was a great sentiment indicator, a great contrary sentiment indicator. The commercials knew what was going on. That doesn't work anymore. And the reason I think it doesn't work is that there are so many different permutations of ways that you can trade the stock market through futures through options or options on ETFs or options on futures that you have diluted what used to be a pure pool of sentiment that you could draw upon and get purified readings. Now there's so many different ways to disguise and cloak it that it just doesn't work very well anymore.
Yeah, one of them is our ETFs. That's a big issue because now you have technically the retail buying the future that may go into the commercial side.
Yeah, back in the old days when it was only the big S&P 500 contract and you either played in that market or you didn't play, then you had everybody in one pool and you could see who was right and who was wrong. Now it's all spread out and it's all a mess. And even when you try to aggregate it and put it together, you can't make sense out of it to get useful data, at least not in the way that I've found.
Right.
So I just set it aside and look at other stuff.
Yeah. The closing question I have for you is this, that I know that you use the AD line, the advanced decline line, a variety of other indicators and things and permutations of it and calculations of it and ratios of it, et cetera, to bring out what you would believe would be either a trend starting, oversold, overbought, et cetera, et cetera. Volume has been a topic lately that has been on a lot of people's mind. When you look at a breakdown, breakout situation, and when you look at a distribution or a constructive zone for markets and stocks, for that matter, how much? The first question is, how much credence do you put into the idea that there should be, or that volume can tell a lot about what's going on? And the follow up question then is, then what do you make of a market that has been in a distribution phase from a volume standpoint and moves up very nicely without any resistance to speak of on very limited volume?
It's a problematic situation. And it's made all the more problematic by virtue of the fact that counting the volume statistics has been much more difficult lately than it was years ago. 10 years ago, nearly all the trading in NYSE-listed stocks took place on the floor. And now the floor only accounts for about a quarter of the volume. And so that gets reported in the consolidated tape system. And there may be other trades that are going on in dark pools that you don't even know about. They don't get counted. So counting volume is not as reliable now as it used to be. And so it creates all sorts of problems and all sorts of reasons to worry. And we could worry about how do we solve that problem, or we could just drive on and figure out, well, what can we make to work and what can we get useful conclusions from, and let's work on how to do that. That tends to be where I put my focus.
Yeah. I mean, I think that all also boils down to the fact, if you want to really sum this up, my opinion is that It all boils down to the fact that there is a high degree of complacency. Now, I'm not saying that's good or bad. I'm just saying a fact. There's a high degree of complacency. There's a high degree of just disinterest in in worrying about things, except for maybe the day traders and maybe for other areas. But right now, there's a general belief that there is a backstop by Bernanke, as you mentioned earlier, the QE and whatever they're doing, the Fed. And there's also, not only here, but around the world, just look at what happened with TEPCO, that now Japan is looking to bail out that utility after that horrible, the continuing horrible situation with the nuclear reactor. So I think, and then you look at the Irish banks that were just bailed out this week also, and also many of the things that go on, like they changed the rules in the middle just to benefit the circumstance. It seems to be an ongoing situation that is I think as a general environmental condition that we are involved in right now. Again, I'm not saying it's good or bad. I'm just saying fact. What I see is fact, and I think that that's something to do with how we're not seeing a lot of real pressure at any given point. Shorts are not looking to really slam in, but yet at the long side, nobody's looking to really resist either.
I can't disagree with what you said. All the factors that you've identified as risk factors will matter someday, but for the moment, the factors that matter is that the Fed is pumping the banking system full of money. We're in the strong seasonal period of the market, and we're in an uptrend.
Right.
So ride the uptrend for what it's worth while the factors are in control, and worry about changing position on what the trend is when we start to see some of those factors change.
Yeah, I'll tell you this in closing. John Markman, I know you know him well, said to me the other day, he said, there are three things you need to really focus in on right now with this market. I said, okay. He says, the Fed. You know, that was his line. I said, okay, John, thank you so much. Appreciate it. Anyway, I appreciate it. Tom McClellan, I know that you have a variety of different subscriptions. You put out your daily, which is a wonderful piece. Everybody can check that out on the website. We will have links to it. It's msoscillator.com. Is that right?
MCoscillator.com.
All right, scratch.
It's like a McNugget, except it's a McOscillator.
See, I said that wrong, so people would listen in to the real one.
And people can sign up on our website for a free weekly subscription to our weekly chart and focus report.
Cool.
No strings attached. We won't bombard you with marketing or anything else. Just learn about the brand, learn about the style of analysis that we do, and it's kind of the drug dealer model. We'll give it to you for free, and we'll hope that we hook you and that you'll like it and want to pay for the good stuff.
Nice. I like it. Nice. The drug dealer model. That's something I'll have to do you have that on your website as one of the things? We subscribe to the drug dealer model, just to let you know. Do you have that anywhere there? No, huh?
No, I don't say it that way. But no. Sign up for the chart and focus. It's free, and there's no strings attached.
I hear you. Tom McClellan, thanks for joining me today.
Good to talk to you.
All right, bye-bye. And that is what they call a wrap. So, Tom McClellan's a great guy because I think, he thinks very clearly and unbiased. That's one of the things I really like about what he talks about. And he gives you just the facts and just the facts and doesn't let opinion swing. Well, maybe sometimes, but doesn't really, get into the minutiae of why, just what is. And I think that's a pretty neat way of looking at some of these conditions that we're seeing right now. Otherwise, I want to thank you again for sending in all the great donations over to the Jason Taylor Foundation. Find that on our webpage. After this week, we're going to take it off. So if you want to, I really do appreciate you sending in anything you can. $100 will get you a copy of my book signed. And of course, if you are looking for money management, if you're looking for us to give you that opportunity to be in or out of the market, whatever the situation is telling us. And in fact, if you want to play along, if you will, we have a website dedicated just to our clients where we go over some of the action that happens during the day. And, you get to see in a transparent nature what we're actually doing inside your portfolio. Kind of cool. You don't really see that often. So what you could do is go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com and see the virtual tour. And you'll get all the information you need and everything you need to kind of understand what's going on. Don't forget to tune in to DH Unplugged, which is every Tuesday night we record it. And it's available Wednesday on iTunes, as well as The Winning Investor. If you haven't checked out that podcast and you're looking for some very basic, understandable key terms and terminology when it comes to the markets, that's the place to get it. All of it's available on iTunes. And maybe next week, I got an iPad this week, gang. Maybe next week I'll bring you some of my best iPad gadgets and things that I found for the markets. Lots of stuff out there. Lots of really neat stuff, actually. And we can go over some of that for all of these that have that. If you have some great apps that you want to share with me, some things that you think are really neat for the iPad, just send it off to me and I'll check it out at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Until next week, I bid you adieu. I wish you well, lots of profitability, and a great week. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.